Here we go. You ready?
Call the Senate Revenue Committee to order. We're continuing with our informational hearings today.
If I can make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Before we get started, Mr. Chair, just a couple of things in front of you. One is your calendar. We've updated through next Tuesday. We do have some more orientation, school finance. Steve Meyer will go through that with you. And we also have an overview of lottery, and we've asked Director Penn to come in and talk to you about the lottery's plans. And, of course, there is a significant increase in lottery revenue in the governor's budget, and he'll address that and the plans for that. On Wednesday and Thursday, we do have some bills scheduled for Wednesday, and I'm working on confirmation on those. So anticipate bills for public hearing and possible work session on Wednesday and Thursday. I did also have just an update for you, something we get every month from Department of Revenue. You may recall Elizabeth showed you this chart with all the colored lines on it, and we do think this is a pretty good indicator of where the economy is, and this is withholding payments from the major employers, from the employers of all those industry categories. And you can very clearly see the recession in those numbers, the thick black line in the middle there. You can see declining from January of 01 till about mid-03 and then trending up modestly. You can see that trend in general continues with the black line. The line that we watch very closely in terms of the business cycle is the red line at the bottom. That is the manufacturing sector. Those are the key employers in our economy. Those are the ones that generate the multiplier effects. And notice that they bottomed out in mid-03 and have come back, really rising fairly significantly into the spring of 04. But since that time, they've been pretty flat. And I think Elizabeth had some data in there through October. These numbers are through December, so withholding payments made at the end of last year by primarily the high-tech industry, the lumber and wood products industry, heavy trucking, metals, all of the key drivers of the state economy are in that manufacturing category. So you can see that while we're not declining, we're in a flat spot in terms of that manufacturing sector.
Thank you. We'll turn now to our panel and introduce yourselves and proceed with the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. My name is Mary Ayala. I don't think I've been introduced to you before, but I'm one of Fall's newest economists. And I'd like to introduce to you, before I begin, the orientation to property taxes. I'd like to introduce to you John Phillips, who's with the Department of Revenue. He's the legislative liaison for the Property Tax Division. And John collaborated with me on the preparation of this material that will be given to you today. And I'll present some of the material that covers property tax legislation, and or that he will present that portion of the presentation that deals specifically with certain measures that are rather complicated, M5, Measure 5 and 50. Because of the complexity of the property tax legislation, we will not cover the history of legislative changes coming up into the current system. And we will not deal with urban renewal either, which is a broad enough topic in and of itself that it requires probably a whole presentation. The orientation to property taxes will be presented in three parts. The first part, briefly, is an overview of tax collection and provides measures that reflect the tax burden on Oregon voters or tax property owners over the past 30 years. The second part covers the property tax structure, focusing on the types of property that are taxed, and you'll hear about the legislation enacted in 91 and 97 that affected property tax levels. Part three is going to describe the tax structure at a sub-state level by looking at the types of taxing districts or service providers. And examples, and we'll end part three with some examples that bring all of these conceptual, you know, notions about measures 5 and 50 into a simplified version of a tax statement where we can show you some concepts about compression, which will be defined as we go through the presentation. Next one. Wait. Oregon's historical growth in property taxes reflects the impact of population growth and economic development, but it also reflects the impact of major changes in Oregon's property tax legislation. Part one of the presentation highlights at a statewide level Oregon's legislative changes that contributed to the variability of Oregon's property tax collections for the past 30 years. During this period, property owners reacted to increases in their property taxes by adopting measures that would impose constraints on the authority of local government and educational taxing districts to raise taxes. Therefore, this part of the presentation highlights trends in two measures of tax burden in order to highlight the degree to which property tax burden has declined in Oregon. Concluding part one, we'll compare how Oregon's tax burden compared with other states over the past 20 years. This first slide illustrates a downward trend in taxes, that's the black line, dotted line, ending in fiscal year 03-04 with a statewide tax rate of about $15 per thousand of assessed value. You'll see that the slide that until fiscal year 97-98, you'll see that real and assessed values there, that's the red and the blue lines, were equivalent, and both were rising steadily over time. After fiscal year 95-96, both real and assessed values continued to increase, but at different rates. And between 1970 and 90, tax rates were very variable, but they began to rise steadily between 1980 and 1990. Between 1980 and 90, the combination of higher assessed values coupled with the higher tax rates caused property taxes to grow by an annual average rate of about 11%. And although today this growth rate may seem to be relatively high, it is useful probably to recall that the nation was burdened at that time with double-digit inflation, and many taxing districts may have needed a growth rate of 11% just to maintain their current levels of service. In 1991 and in 1997, Oregonians adopted two measures that constrained local taxing authorities' ability to raise their property taxes. These measures will be discussed in the next part of the presentation, part two. However, the slide does present and reveal the effectiveness of the two voter measures. In 1990, the average property tax rate for the state plummeted, and by 1996, the real market value began to diverge from assessed value, and those were the effects of those measures. The second slide I'll discuss for you. Basically, voters are alarmed when their property taxes increase. However, if their incomes are rising at the same or faster rate, the tax burden actually on property owners can actually be neutral or decreasing. Same thing applies with inflation. If your wages are rising as fast as in the prices of goods and services, you're effectively not hurt by that. This slide illustrates that the economic climate in 1990 and 91 was probably perfect for voters' reaction to rising property taxes. The slide converts taxes that were levied between fiscal year 83 and fiscal year 91 into taxes per capita and taxes as a share of personal income. The bar chart, which is the histogram there in red, shows that the taxes as percentage of personal income had been increasing year after year until fiscal year 90-91. At fiscal year 91, property taxes absorbed about 4.9% of personal income in the state. The statewide average tax rate at this point was about almost $27 per thousand of taxable property. After voters approved Measure 5, in 91, property taxes as a share of personal income declined until fiscal year 95-96, at which point taxes absorbed only about 3.2% of personal income. Measure 5 limited tax rates, but it also required that limits for education previously set at $15 per thousand of real market value would be reduced each year for a period of 5 years by $2.50 per thousand. Okay. It also set a governmental limit of $10 per thousand real market value. So at the end of the period ending FY96, the average statewide tax rate stood at an all-time low of about $13 per thousand of assessed value. That's a decline from $26 to $13 per real market or per assessed value. Notice I switched to saying assessed value because of the switch there, where in 95 or 97 there is a divergence between real market and assessed value. When voters approved Measure 50 in 1997, assessed values were rolled back substantially, but tax rates increased over the prior year by about 11%. At this point in time, following the rollback, property taxes accounted for 3.1%, so there was a rollback in value, but an increase in rate, but the burden stayed about the same. Okay. And the statewide rate was about 14.87 per thousand of assessed value. Since 97, property taxes as a share of personal income have been increasing very slowly. By fiscal year 2003, the share had increased to about 3.27%. And in fiscal year 2003-04, based on estimated taxes of $3.5 billion and a personal income estimate of about $106 billion, as recently reported by the USBEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis, property taxes as a share of personal income was about 3.3%. Note the rising trend per capita personal income has not been adjusted for inflation. Okay, and therefore, this sort of overstates, it's really rather not really an accurate measure of the burden of the tax, because if I divided the taxes, right, if it's by the inflation rate and then took per capita, it would be fairly flat. Right, now, to end this section, or nearly end it, I'll give you another slide that just shows you over at a statewide level how Oregon compares with other states for the past 20 years. Since tax burden can be measured in terms of either, and I like the per capita one, not the per capita, but the taxes as a share of personal income a little bit better than the one per capita, it's useful to review how Oregon measures up. The rankings for property taxes as a percentage of personal income are presented in this slide. And notice in 1990-91, the tax burden measured by its ranking of 6 was among the highest in the nation. However, following measures 5 and 50, by fiscal year 97-98, the state's property tax burden dropped significantly to a ranking of about 25. Okay. Since fiscal year 98, Oregon's ranking has remained in the mid-range relative to other states. The next two slides that I'm going to present you, which conclude part one of this presentation, are for illustration. They basically show you how assessed values, total assessed values, and average tax rates for each county. This one is just showing you total assessed values. Similar data are reported in much more detail in the current LRO report called 2005 Oregon Public Finance Tax, which I believe you have a copy of, or we could present you with one. And the DOR's publication of its property tax statistics. Both reports available here or can be accessed, I believe, on the websites for these agencies. The rankings of counties by their assessed value in fiscal year 04 illustrates that about 46% of assessed value in the state could be accounted for by three counties. Actually, I don't know that you would recognize all the numbers on here, but they're Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. 24% of the assessed value is located within another four counties, Lane, Marion, Jackson, and Deschutes. 9% of the assessed value is located in four counties, Lynn, Douglas, Benton, and Lincoln. And the remaining 20% are accounted for by the remaining 25 counties in the state. The maximum assessed value was $45.5 billion. The minimum was about $76 million. And the average was about $11.8 billion. 50% of the county's assessed values fell above $3.9 billion, which is the median value. This was the second slide I promised to show you that concludes this presentation, the first part of the presentation. This just gives you similar data for property tax rates in fiscal year 03-04, and they ranged between $8.9 per thousand of assessed value in Cook County to about $20 per thousand in Multnomah County. Average and median rates as percentages of net assessed value were roughly $14.2 per thousand in both cases for the average and the median, so it's pretty much normally distributed there. The LRO current report, table D5, gives you these data and compares them to FY02-03 values in case you want to see some historical growth rates. For example, some rates increased between a tenth of a percent to almost to 8.8% in Benton County, and in 13 counties, rates actually declined a tenth of a percent. Summarize here briefly. Over the past 20 years, assessed values of property and property tax rates varied substantially. Inflation and voters' reactions to increases in property taxes contributed to the variability. Voter approval of Measure 5 in 1990 marked the end of a long period of rising tax rates, ending with $24 per real market value. In 03-04, the statewide average tax rate stands at roughly $15 of assessed value and about $11 per thousand of real market value. Voter approval of Measure 50 in 1997 marked the end of a long period of rising property assessments that were driven by market values. The combination of Measure 5 and 50 constraints stabilized the pattern of growth in property taxes. Property tax burden in fiscal year 91, measured as a tax divided by personal income, reached a high point of 4.9%. Since 97, property taxes as a percent of personal income have remained about below 3.5%. Compared with other states, between fiscal year 91 and fiscal year 2000, Oregon's ranking with respect to property tax burden has declined in a major way. That is, in fiscal year 2000, property taxes as a percentage of personal income are lower, the rank being 25, relative to its rank of 6 in 1991, or 8 in fiscal year 92. In FY03-04, total assessed value for county ranged between $76 million and $45 billion. 50% of the county assessed values were above $3.9 billion. In fiscal year 03-04, tax rates per county ranged between $8, or roughly $9, and $20 per thousand. 50% of the tax rates were above $14 per thousand. And that concludes this particular section. The second section that we're going to cover this morning deals with the types of property that are subject to property tax. It does not cover every exemption, but those can be found in the Department of Revenue's 2005 Tax Expenditure Report. It focuses primarily on the tax structure. That is, I'll illustrate shortly that property taxes are labeled in several different ways because some types of property are designated for operations, others for construction, infrastructure, and capital projects, and still others for special purposes, such as urban renewal. Some of the tax categories are subject to more legislative constraints than others, which is why they're broken out differently. Part 2 ends with an overview of Measures 5 and 50, which John will present for us. And there'll be some examples at the end of this section where I can demonstrate to you how these measures affect a tax bill. What property is taxed? Real property and personal property are taxed. Real property includes land itself and all buildings and structures erected upon it. Personal property, except for inventories, which means all movable possessions, merchandise, furniture, livestock, vehicles, tools, and equipment. Also some personal property. and some intangible personal property is taxed. Licenses owned by centrally assessed properties, for example. This particular graph will show you in real terms, rather the real market values, that 92% of property values are accounted for by real property and reflect a growth rate of about 8%, real property being, of course, your buildings, your homes, things like that. In FY03-04, a growth rate of 8% over the prior year reflects the surge probably in home constructions and sales that continued this year because of low mortgage rates. Personal property reflected a growth rate of about 2.3%, slower than the growth in real property because Oregon is slowly coming out of a recession and probably companies delayed purchasing and replacing capital investments. If you'd like to see this kind of detail at a more detailed level, table, I believe it's A4 in the DOR, Department of Revenue's report, will provide you with that detailed data. Differences are very slight, but between real market value and assessed value. However, as we said earlier, because of the legislation, they began to diverge after 97. Assessed value, real property, equals about 90% of total assessed value and grew about 6.3% over the last 5 years. As reported in the previous slide, real market value for a residential property was 92% of real market value and referenced an average growth rate of about 8%. Personal property here equals about 3.7% of assessed value and grew at an annual rate of about 2.6%. Comparing this data with the previous slide, real market value growth was about the same percentage. Public utilities equal about 4.9% of assessed value and grew at an annual average of about 4.2%. Just comparing the two for a second, you see that real market values and assessed values were roughly, real market values, assessed value is roughly 74% of real market value. This ratio will be important later as we go through the discussion that John will give you that shows you how new property is added to the roll, tax rolls, or how additions to current property are added to the roll. Now, wait a minute. Is this your part? Okay. All right, let's continue here with property tax structure. The major components of the tax structure, characteristics of permanent rate, characteristics of local option, election, and three other components of the tax structure. First component, permanent local rate, established by Measure 50, is based on the levy amount that supplements local budgetary needs. The general obligation bonds are another component of the tax structure. Property taxes collected to repay indebtedness on bonds that are issued for long-term capital projects. Characteristics of permanent rates. Districts cannot increase the permanent rates. However, some districts did not get a permanent rate in the M50 calculation. Other districts have spun off some services, and their rates have not changed. Moreover, districts may choose to impose a rate that is less than its permanent rate. Non-schools can impose less than full tax rate authority. New taxing districts can establish permanent rates. And merging districts set rates to raise some total revenue. Existing rate is extended to annexed property. General obligation bond debt. This is bond debt that's exempt from Measure 5 limits, which John will explain to you in a bit. They must be approved in a general election to get 50% turnout. They can bond five-year public safety vehicles. General obligation bonds cannot be used for the following: reasonably anticipated maintenance and repairs, supplies and equipment not intrinsic to structure. Three other components of the property tax structure. There are called gap bonds, which are debt obligations that were unable to be rolled up in the Measure 50 17% reduction. They are principal and interest obligations of taxing districts that are paid using operating revenues. Urban renewal bonds, property taxes collected to repay indebtedness on bonds issued by the urban renewal bonding agencies. And again, we're not going to cover this portion in the process there in about urban renewal today. And there are local option taxes, which add additional tax rates that are imposed for special purposes for 5 or 10 years, depending on whether they're a five-year project. 5 years are longer ones. 10 years are long-term capital improvements. The 10-year time frame is allowed for a capital improvement, and the 5-year is for a smaller type of project. Characteristics of the local option: their levies outside the permanent rate limit, and they may be approved at a general election or an election with 50% turnout. Their operating revenues, levies that are limited to 5 years. Capital levies are limited to the lesser or useful life of 10 years, and levies can be a rate or levy based and are subject to Measure 5. The school local option, 1999 House Bill 2753 allowed K-12 districts to seek voter approval of local option taxes. 17 school districts have received voter approval for local option levies beginning in 2000-2001. And since Measure 50, community colleges could ask voters for local option levies. This portion of the presentation I'd like to hand off to John, who's going to continue. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips, and I'm with the Department of Revenue. We set aside a section of this presentation for an overview of Measures 5 and 50 because the ongoing effects of these two measures have some on the flexibility of the property tax has had some significant ongoing effects on both taxing districts' ability to raise additional revenue and the legislature's ability to assist in that area too. There's some constraints put on the system in both terms of value and tax levying authority, which we'll go into. Two key things that does, though: one, it creates a certainty for taxpayers. Since Measure 50, for the most part, unless you've changed your property, you can expect only a 3% change in your property tax bill. And secondly, it provides relative stability of the property tax. As Paul mentioned earlier in the week and Mary today, we rank extremely high nationwide on the property tax for number 7th and 9th prior to Measure 5, and it was just after that Measure 5 was passed back in 1989. A handful of taxing districts across the state in the county had tax rates that ranged from anywhere, all of the taxing districts together ranging from $29 to $32 when you add them all together on a given property. That's how high it was at that time. One of them had a rate as high as $37 per thousand. Now, today, we look back at that same county with a $37 per thousand rate, and it is just slightly over $15 per thousand. So you can see that the impact of Measure 5 and since then Measure 50 has had a lot of difference on the actual tax bills that property owners pay. Now, in some cases, the changes required by these two measures were pretty dramatic. In some cases, the county assessor had to actually reprogram their entire systems to deal with the new values, the new tax rates, and the new calculation. In some counties, it required the county assessor to buy a computer to do that because they'd been on paper up until that point. So this has been a dramatic change for counties. Your counties that you represent, your county assessors, to deal with these changes. Come a long way. The next slide Oh, we're already past that. Let's just move on to this slide. And basic Measure 50 principles, I just wanted to point out here that we did retain a Measure 50 that was passed in 97 by the voters that you referred to them, was retained the Measure 5 limits. That's that $5 and the $10 limit that Mary talked about, $5 for schools, $10 for general government, and of course we have the bond, the bonded indebtedness, the GO bond, general obligation bond, which was unlimited. So sometimes if you see a rate, a tax rate that's over $15, it is the excess of the $15 is coming from that non-limited category of bonds. So it did retain the Measure 5 limits. It rolled back taxable value to the 1995-1996 real market value minus 10%. It limited the growth on that value. See, that was a problem with Measure 5. It limited the tax rates. But then the value started to increase, as it was demonstrated in Mary's slide. The values increased, tax rate against a higher value was more tax. So Measure 50 came along, limited the value, rolled it back. The next thing it did is it consolidated levy authority. Up until that point, taxing districts had a wide variety of levy authority, everywhere from what we used to call a tax base. You remember that concept? That was in Constitution, and it allowed the tax base, which is a dollar amount, to increase by 6% per year. It took that rate, it took millage rate, it took serial levies, it took a lot of different taxing authority and rolled it all up into what was called the permanent tax rate, which taxing districts cannot change through a vote of their patrons. So it's permanent. Not a lot of things are permanent, but so far that's been permanent. And it also restricts exempted bonds on capital projects. Up until that point, some capital projects were thought to be perhaps computers were maybe included in the capital projects, and this was a little more constricted in Measure 50. It restricted it more to capital buildings and longer-term capital investments. So that was sort of the cap and the cut that was referred to back in Measure 50. The next slide, the rollback, and I just mentioned this briefly, but this was the rollback to the 1995-96 values minus 10%. So everyone received sort of all property that existed in 97 received this reduction in the value on their property that was actually taxed as a result of this rollback. Now, it was also assumed that there would be new property at some point. Not all property existed in 1997. There's new property today. New personal property, for example. A new home is built, for example. And there was a question about, okay, how are we going to treat that property? And so what was created was this ratio, and Mary referred to this, and that's when you saw that slide that compared real market value to assessed value. That's the point at which, on a countywide basis, the assessor will look at, let's say you're looking at a residential property, a home, and on that home, you look at all the homes in that county, and you look at the real market value compared to the maximum assessed value, which is this concept I'll talk about. It's reflecting that rolled back value. And you see what that difference is, and if a new home is built, that's the ratio you apply to that new home. You look at the new home, you assign a market value to the new home, and then you apply that percentage. It might be 74%, as Mary had in her slide. And that's their taxable value, just to give you a sense of how that's done. Measure 50 allowed taxable value to grow, and you've probably heard that it grows by 3%. But the only, we're not trying to teach you how to calculate value growth here. You've got other more important things to do probably, but the two principles that are here is, one, it is limited to 3%. It doesn't have to grow by 3%, but it can grow no more than 3% unless you have something changed on the property that qualifies as an exception, which we'll talk about. But the other principle is that it can freeze also. And that can happen in a circumstance we'll demonstrate briefly. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. In this example, we're going to show you how it grows and then how it freezes. So let's just assume that the real market value on a new home is an existing home is $150,000. Its maximum assessed value, which is the value that it reflects that rollback from Measure 50, the 1995-96 minus 10%. That's maximum assessed value is the part that grows no more than 3%. And then the assessed value is the lesser, always the lesser of the two. So when someone asks you, can my taxable value be higher than my market value? You would say no, because it can never be higher. It has to be the lesser of the top two values up there. So in year one, let's just say we have that $150,000 real market value, $125,000 maximum value, which is the value then you're going to be taxed on. It's the lesser of the two. In year two, you apply this 103%, 100% test. In year two, what you see is the real market value has gone down. It's depreciated. Not necessarily common for residential property, but it does happen. It can happen on personal property and other kinds of property. So this is why we're using it as an example. It drops. The maximum assessed value is 103%, which comes out to $128,750. The assessed value is always going to be the lesser of the two, obviously $112,500. The next year, in year three, you apply the test again, and you see that the real market value, because the market fluctuates, it's gone up again in excess of the maximum value. So in this case, the maximum assessed value is 100% of the assessed value from the previous year. That's why that's in there, is because it freezes at any time the real market drops below the taxable, so that you don't have this ever-increasing amount. That's just the point I wanted to make here, is that it is always going to be lesser of the two, and the maximum taxable value will freeze whenever the real market drops. That protects the property owner against this fluctuating market, and all of a sudden one year their property taxable amount would maybe go up 10-15% if it weren't for this freeze. The next slide, I referenced exceptions. So there's always an exception. And so we have this limit and we have this freeze, but we have some exceptions, and the legislature understood that. You understood back in 97 that people might build a new house and it didn't exist in 96 or 97, and so it should receive some kind of a reduction, but also the taxable value of that. If you just loaned the land, let's say I just owned a bare lot and I build a home on it, the next year I shouldn't be taxed just on the land. There should be some taxable value that's attributable to the new construction. So new construction is an example where value can grow. If you subdivide property, that's an example where your taxable value can grow because your actual market value increases. Omitted property, rezoning, and loss of an exemption, those are other conditions. So in those situations, new taxable value is added to that account. There's also situations where you might have new construction, but it's minor. And so the statute defines minor construction as being anything in a given year under $10,000 over a five-year period of less than $25,000. So in those cases, your taxable value won't change. And the example given in 97 was, hey, if I build a deck in my backyard, do I want the assessor to be running out there, you know, checking on people's back decks to see if they should increase their taxes? And the answer was no, we don't want to do that. And so that was the threshold that was established. This new property that comes on as an exception, whether it's new construction or one of the other four I mentioned, comes on at this average rate I referred to. And we'll just give you a real brief example of this. New construction of a home of, let's say it's a $150,000 home. And the assessor looks at all the residential property in the county, and we just give you three examples here. And on these three properties, you can see the real market, the market value of those properties, the taxable value of those properties, and the assessor creates an average ratio. In this case, the average ratio is 78%. So you might own this bare lot, you build a $150,000 home, the assessor will look at the new home, value it, apply the ratio, and add that to your taxable value on your land for your total taxable value. I mentioned that Measure 50 consolidated levy authority, and we did talk a little bit about the permanent rate, voter-approved tax basis. It includes millage levies, the gap bonds, and that these are set. The way new revenue is raised for local taxing districts is the same tax rate. That permanent rate is multiplied by any increase in the value. And sometimes that's 3%, sometimes it's more or less than that, depending on new construction. Many of us have CPAs calculate our income taxes for us, and for property tax, we have our county assessor do it for us. And so I'm not going to go over in too much detail the calculation, but in the old days, it was tax rate times value equals tax. Today, there's an intermediary step where we extend the tax, which is the rate times the value. Then we apply that measure 5 limitation we talked about. Now, okay, do either of these categories exceed the $5 or the $10 limit? We do what we call compress, or we reduce those amounts down to those $5 and $10 limits, and then we actually impose a tax after that. All of that won't fit on a tax statement. So your tax statement cannot handle all of that unless we published a book for everybody. But this is what happens behind the scenes. So that covers sort of Measure 5, how it was retained when Measure 50 was passed, and some of the provisions in Measure 50 that limit value growth, provide certainty and stability to the system.
Okay, that.
Okay, for a summary of Part 2 then, we've got most real property and some personal property that's taxed, and those value growths, as Mary mentioned. The assessed value and real market represent about 90% of the tax base. Summary of the rest of it there. Maybe we'll just skip over that for the time we have. And finally, on Part 2, summary of... Look at the next slide there. And I sort of went over this already. I apologize for this. Measure 5 limits are in effect. We created an artificial value ceiling. The Measure 50 limits the growth. Consolidated the levy authority. Restricts local option and new levy authority. And created the double majority requirement. There have been 4 constitutional amendments proposed since Measure 50. 2 of them dealt with the double majority. Can we change that? That was the question. They both failed. 2 of them dealt with the levy authority. Can we change the levy authority? They both failed. So we're still at where we were constitutionally, which is mostly contained in Article 11 of the Constitution, of all of the Measure 5 and 50 requirements.
Okay. The last section of our presentation will focus on local taxes by taxing district. We'll focus on who levies taxes on property, distribution of property taxes by type of tax and taxing district, and we'll try to look at the components of a tax statement with some examples of compression, which we'll define as we go through the presentation. In 2003-04, Oregon had more than 1,500 different taxing districts categorized as either educational or government. The school districts were the K-12s, community colleges, and educational special districts that accounted for 45% of property tax collections. Cities and county taxing districts accounted for another 40%, and urban renewal and special districts accounted for about 14%. Not all districts have taxing authority. This particular table is also presented in as Table D2 of the LRO report that you may have a copy of there. We'll give you more detail than this, but the K-12s account for the largest share of property taxes collected in the state, almost $1.43 billion for K-12s, plus another $207 million for educational districts and community colleges. The largest share of revenue for schools in fiscal year 03-04 were taxes from the permanent rate authority, and it totaled about 73% of the revenue collections. Cities and counties collected $1.46 billion, or about 40% of property taxes. The collections from permanent rate authority accounted for about 79%. However, in fiscal year 03-04, revenues from exercising local option authority increased over 100% for cities, which explains a good 9% of increase in revenues over the prior year. Urban renewal and special districts accounted for the remainder, about 10% for special districts and another 3.8% for urban renewal. Again, more statistics are available in the DOR publication. Fiscal year 03-04, in that year, property tax revenues totaling about $3.6 billion grew by 5.8% over the prior year. City revenues grew by 9%. Contributing to this growth was the increase to about $53 or $54 million in local option taxes that reflected a growth rate of about 155%. They were very successful in that. K-12 revenues grew by 5.4%, also aided by the growth in local option taxes of about $59 million, which that area reflected a growth rate of 59%. Although taxes for educational districts have increased over time, as this slide reveals, they have not retained the share of property tax revenues they once enjoyed a decade ago. And we explained earlier why this happened with that rollback, that cut from almost, what, $15 a share down to $15? Right, there was that repetitive decrease in down to 5%. Components of the tax statement. This will just be sort of a summary to all of the pieces of information that you've been given this morning. John particularly highlighting how we compress and all of that and how it affects a particular tax statement. Well, we'll just go through an example of that for you. The major components, of course, of anybody's tax statement would be the identifiers, which include your taxpayer number and code area. And that code area identifies a unique combination of taxing districts. So, for example, if the vice chair, Mr. Senator Starr, lived in one neighborhood and was served by, let's say, five different districts, and let's say Senator Deathart lived very close to you, but within a different code area, because one of the five districts that serve you might be very different. So each code area represents a unique set of distech or providers, so to speak, and that's what the code area does. So the tax bill will tell you what code area that is, what code area you're in. And that's important because of the compression that we're going to show you, how taxes can be compressed. And if you go over certain limits, like the $5 and the $10 limits for educational and non-educational categories, then there you have to come back down to those limits. And each of these many areas or that serve a particular property may not know what the other's doing. And so at a certain point, when all the taxes are rolled up, if you exceed that $5 and $10 limit, right, they have to be rolled back to a certain constraint, and that's what the compression is by definition. Okay. Property values. On your tax roll, on the tax statement, you'll see your property values, your real market value, and you'll see your assessed value. That's subject to taxation. And you'll see the tax amounts for each district. Here's a typical, let's say, simplified version of a tax statement that shows you a property has its taxpayer ID instead of your name. It has a code area. It's important for the reasons I just discussed with you about the compression. It has a real market value, in this example, of $150,000, and $125,000 is the assessed value. You've got the taxing districts broken out in blue and red there for educational versus government districts, because each is subject to a different constraint. Of course, the educational district is subject to the $5 constraint, and the government districts are subject in total. Overall, the districts are subject to that $5 constraint. Or $10 constraint. Okay. In this particular instance, you'll see the total bill, tax bill that is subject to these Measure 5 and 50 constraints totals $1,650, $750 for education, $900 for government. Bonds are not subject to that constraint, so they're sitting there over on the side. Example 1, when compression is not needed. Okay. Okay. I've simplified this so that we are just going to focus on the government non-school, you know, the non-school taxing districts. I've blocked out the portion that dealt with education, but the same process would occur. This slide and several others will build on the same data that I just showed you. It has the same basic values. To simplify it, we'll just look at the governmental section. Notice that the M5 limits must be tested and satisfied for each count. That's each property owner. It isn't satisfied at the county level or at the district level. It has to be subject. Each parcel, each property owner has to go through this compression review, so to speak. Okay. And here are the limits we just discussed. The school measure, the $5 limit for schools, the $10 limit for $1,000 for government. Okay. Now, in this particular example, compression of the governmental limit, how compression value is applied to each tax statement. So pretend this is your tax bill, and you've exceeded the limit. Your total taxes come up to $1,800, okay, which is greater than the limit you're allowed. The maximum limit is $1,500 for this particular property. How are we going to compress it to get back to satisfy that $1,500 limit? Right now you're at $12. Okay, it's greater than the M5 limit, $10. Okay. We take the percentages for each property as a percent of the total in this initial billing, and county taxes with, let's say, a $900 addition to the tax that we didn't have in the previous slide, but suppose the county decided to impose a higher tax rate of $900, totaling $1,225, 68% of the total bill, so to speak. Well, $1,800 exceeds the limit. And so we have to go through what's called compression, come back to the correct amount. Okay. So we figure the percentages. County taxes before the compress represent 68%. City taxes represent 21%. The other taxes represent 7% and 4%, respectively. Okay. We take those percentages and we basically apply them to the overage. We know that the $1,500 is the M5 limit. $1,800 is what we previously came up with as a total before we compress. So we have to get rid of roughly $300. The compression is, we've got to come back to $1,500, so we have to lose, so to speak, $300 on this particular property. We do that by using the percentages that we originally computed off the bill that was too high, and we took 68% of that $300 excess and we subtract it from the amount that the county would like to have independently of what the other jurisdictions or taxing districts would like to have, and the county tax is reduced down to $1,000, and that those percentages are applied to each of these other dollar amounts as well, and you end up by losing the $300, and this is the final bill. We've compressed the tax statement for that particular property owner. Notice, though, that in this you can see that it was the original decision or decision of the county to take its rate up to maybe its maximum limit that created the compression that affects all of the other districts as well. So it's rather interesting from my perspective to think if you're in a county or a city or one of these districts and you're operating independently and perhaps your budget said in the county you needed that $1,225. Right, but because of the compression, you're not going to end up with that. So it's rather tricky, I would think, to figure out how to make your budget, how to balance your budget. I don't know about the intricacies of that.
Senator George.
Was that part of 47 and 50 when we did that? Because that doesn't seem fair to me. Did we do that?
It's the way it works.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, actually, back in Measure 5, this was acknowledged as a potential problem, and the statute created a situation where all the districts prior to levying would come together and discuss it and have this conversation. And then Measure 50 changed it a little bit in that it prioritized in compression, which Mary will talk about, the local option levy, which is a levy over and above your permanent rate. So it's almost assumed that most taxing districts, without exception, are going to levy their full permanent rate. I think there are a couple of exceptions, but most of them will levy their permanent rate, so that part is no surprise to the other districts. Mm-hmm. If they levy a local option tax, that could throw all of the districts into compression, except that in Measure 50, the local option is prioritized, and Mary will go into that.
Okay. The next slide will talk about local options that are levied to the city. Suppose that the $900 increment that I just showed you on the previous tax statement was caused by a $450 increase in taxes and a $450 increase in local option. In this case, the local option has to be compressed first, and so in this case, we're talking about two local options, and it's compressed using the percentages, 50% of it applied here to the county and 50% here, and you get an application of the rule that I just showed you to reduce the amount to the required amount. When the tax rate increases and a local option levy exceeds Measure 5 limit, we compress the local options before the permanent rate, and that will bring the dollar amount down. Okay. And that satisfies the governmental limit. Over time, over these years, you can see that compression has taken its toll more so on the schools back in 94, 95, 96 than it did relative to the other jurisdictions. But I think we pointed out earlier there may have been less opportunities for schools to get the incremental, the local option tax. They have the local option tax later than the cities and counties got their option to exercise a local option. So the schools were constrained by that for a while. Summarizing this section, in fiscal year 03-04, Oregon had over 1,500 taxing districts categorized as educational or government. Property taxes totaled about $3.6 billion. Educational districts collected about 45% of these taxes. Cities and counties collected about 40.5%. And special districts collected 10%. Urban renewal got roughly 4%. And, gentlemen, that concludes our presentation of the three sections of this of the report on property taxes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions for the panel on property taxes. Senator George.
Yes. So the only way that you would have not a division in the household here, over, in other words, the city and the county, would be that they would be required to negotiate that if, in fact, they were facing that compression. And that, therefore, they would, one of them would say, well, because my response would be, if you're the county and I'm the city and you did that to me, I just raised mine up so I would, my reduction would bring it back. So the balancing is that they're going to go head-to-head in negotiation, recognizing that they have that limit.
I hope they pre-negotiate. I don't know, though, that they do.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think it's, I don't know what the discussions are out there, but I think most districts are going to impose their full permanent rate.
Right.
And so that's not necessarily something they would negotiate. And then when it comes to the local option, there's so many factors involved. They have to establish what it is they're going to fund with the local option. Are they going to fund operation or a capital project? Is it something that voters will support? Can they make the double majority if it's not a general election? If they get support, how much money will they raise? That's a question a lot of assessors get. You know, well, what is the compression? And we know that that's done on an account-by-account basis, so there's no way without running a tax roll in its entirety to know exactly what that would be. So there's a lot of questions when a district decides to go out for a local option. And when they do, they know that the first thing that will be compressed is their local option, or at least in equal parts with any other taxing district that's achieved approval, voter approval of a local option. So if you have a city that has a local option, a county that has a local option, and a and a library district, for example, with three local options, and an account has compression, as Mary pointed out, those three will experience a percentage reduction. They'll share that. And then if there's any taxes levied from the permanent rates in excess of the limit at that point, then and only then will those other permanent rates be reduced. So the system sort of protects the ongoing operating levy authority as a priority. Does that answer your question?
Just follow up with what John said, Senator George, is that where we've really seen the most discussion and had the most questions of us has been on the school district local option.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they really faced a couple of problems. As John said, it's very difficult for them to calculate how much they're actually going to bring in.
Yeah.
So because it does vary property by property. And the biggest problem assessors have had, as they've told us, is that, you know, you've got a local option on the ballot, and, you know, the question is, well, how much is it going to affect taxpayers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is it depends on your assessment ratio. What is your assessed value relative to your market value? If you're at market value and there's a local option passed, you may not be affected at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you have variation by individual property of the effect of that local option. And that's been very confusing. Mm-hmm. For proponents of local option, particularly school districts, try to explain the impact on their voters.
And that, what was there, only 17 that have made it, I think, according to your presentation? So,
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe Mary said 17 school districts.
School districts, okay.
And, Senator, we do have a special report that Steve Meyer put out on success of those local options over the last 5 years since we've had them in place.
Can we include that when we do school finance next week? I know that's a little bit out of the formula, mm-hmm. but it'd be interesting mm-hmm. to look at
mm-hmm.
just when Steve's here to do school finance.
Mm-hmm. We'll certainly include that, and we'll make sure you have a copy of that report because it was done in, I believe, completed in September, so it's very relatively recent.
Paul, just one question or to the panel. So are school districts, just on the issue that we were just discussing, are they able to at least have some level of predictability? And it sounds perhaps not, that when they go out for a local option, basically, are we up against compression? Are we close to compression? So that allows them the ability, I think of Hillsborough, which recently had this discussion. How close are we, and can we go out and have a discussion with voters and have some level of predictability that if it is a pass, we're going to receive that amount of dollars because we're going to avoid compression?
Well, I would think if you have your prior year data in front of you, you know whether or not you're close to compression or not, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can kind of estimate based on that. And remember, the compression is always subject to the new level of real market value, too. And that's mm-hmm. growing at a certain percent. So you'd have to build that in a little bit. But, yes, you could kind of guess.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, we've had probably the district that knew the most when they went out in a local option was Portland because they had my predecessor as their superintendent
at that time.
That's right. And so he was able to actually go on property by property basis and get a pretty good estimate. But we did have some problems initially, particularly Corvallis. I know I did not bring in they probably brought in maybe 60 to 70% of what they estimated. So. But keep in mind the way that the Measure 5 and Measure 50 limits will work over time. If you're in a high-growth district, your market value is going to be growing a lot faster than your assessed value. Mm-hmm. So that gap is going to be widening. So the bigger that gap, the safer you are in your prediction in most cases. And that would also be true the more uniform your growth is within your district. So your properties are all growing about the same rate. So that's going to be the ideal situation in terms of predicting what your revenue is. If you're in a slow growth district where properties have not grown much, then you're going to have a lot more difficult time estimating, and compression is more likely to be an issue.
Senator,
can I ask a question, Paul? Paul, in the Corvallis example, because they didn't achieve the full amount, that meant that also other taxing districts did take a loss because of the fact that an increase was present. Would that be the case,
Senator?
Because they went into compression, that would have reduced everyone else.
Keep in mind, Senator, that the local option is compressed first.
Okay.
And there's an example that's what Measure 50 did. It singled out the local option. Now, it could be some other option may have been affected by
mm-hmm.
it, but the local option taxes are adjusted before the permanent rate.
So local options would have been grouped, and then all of them are taken ahead for the one.
So if not all taken out of the local option, when that compression to Corvallis occurred, they compressed the local option, but they also compressed the other services after they had done.
They would compress the other local options, but would not compress the permanent rates.
Just the local options.
So the city and county permanent rates would not have been affected.
My question.
Thank you. And that concludes our presentation, gentlemen.
We're not done. We're just our presentation just started. Questions or? Well, thank you. Welcome, Dr. Ayala. From we saved you from at least a few hurricanes down in Florida, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So welcome to Oregon. This is our winters are all balmy and 65 degrees.
Is this normal? Going from, it's the norm going from 29 degrees to 60 degrees in a 5-day period?
You don't like the weather rates I've been
at. Meteorologist.
Very.
Mr. Chair, we always assign our new economist to the property tax rate as our equivalent of hot coals for
Thank you very much. We're done for the week. Next week we're going to start doing bills on Wednesday. We do school finance with Steve Meyer. Then we'll have the lottery and a full discussion on Tuesday of next week of the lottery. And we'll have Mr. Penn in talking to us about all the issues with the lottery in terms of forecasting, line games, lottery compensation rates. That whole world will be on Tuesday, and then we'll start in on bills on Wednesday. And then we've tabbed the following week to do one to start in on our work on the whole collections and compliance issue that we talked about earlier. Welcome. Are you official?
Official today. Day at when we have session, it'll be announced.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for attending even as an unofficial vice chair. We are adjourned till Monday. Have a good weekend.
Do I have to